Lecture 1, Introduction to the Study of Language.
Hello. Welcome to this course of lectures on the history of the English language. In this series of lectures, we're going to be looking at the English language, its history, and its structure, from its origins as a Germanic dialect until present-day American English. But we're also going to be looking at the social, the literary, and the cultural contexts of English. We'll be examining its prehistory in the world of Indo-European, and we'll be examining, too, what we might think of as the afterlife of English in American regional dialects and in the Anglophone world that so compels us today to re-examine and explore our language and our culture. But before we begin, we need to get a good sense of what English is. What does the word English mean? Does it refer simply to the language of a nation or a people? Or is it more a touchstone for a history of culture and the experience of our environment? Let's begin with things that may not seem to us immediately as English. Nu schulan herian, heaven riches word, meotidis mechte, and his modiathank, werk wulderfader. Is that English? Or how about this? Juan that April, with his shore sochte, the drocht of March, hath persed to the rote, and bathed every vein in switch liqueur, of which vertu engendred is the floor. Is that English? Tobe or not tobe? That is the question. Is that English? 47 years ago, is that English too? All the things I've just quoted are English, from Old English, through Middle English, through Early Modern, and to 19th century American English, bits and pieces that will be familiar to you, but some that will be new to you. In this opening two lectures, I'd like to explore with you some of the problems and questions that motivate our historical study of the English language. And then, in the course of the lecture series, I'd like to explore some details, some contexts, and some texts that may help us understand where English came from, what its literary and cultural artifacts are, and where it might be going in the future. Now let's begin with some large questions. When we come to study the history of the English language, we see many of the debates that we ourselves today find ourselves engaged in. These are debates with a history and a context, and by looking at them in particular, we can understand something of our own contemporary cultural and social problems. But there's also a fascination to watching these debates in history. And it seems to me that a good place to begin is to ask the question, should there be a standard English? This is a question which we have heard today in many, many contexts. But if you were to look back in time to the 10th century, to the age of King Alfred or his literary successors, Bishop Aelfrich or Bishop Wulfstan, you'd find the same question. Should there be a standard English? Some claimed that there should be rules of spelling, of pronunciation, of regional dialect and usage. In the 10th and the 11th century, these debates were played out in the Anglo-Saxon schoolroom. In the Middle Ages, in the Renaissance, and in the 19th century, these debates were argued in schools, in courts, in chancery, in the writing office of the King of England, and also in the colonial and commercial contexts of expansion. American English similarly functions as a problem of standard and invites us to ask questions about whether we take a regional standard as our model or whether we take models based on education, on class, on learning. When we ask questions about standards in the history of the English language, we also have to ask questions about method. And the central question, it seems to me, about the method and study of English is really this. Should the study of English be prescriptive or descriptive? Now, what do I mean by these terms? When we study English, or for example, when we make and use a dictionary, we are ostensibly recording spelling, pronunciation, meaning, and usage. But by recording these facets of a word, we may also be codifying them. We may present features of a language that are, in other words, prescriptive. That is, we are recording how we should speak or how we should write, rather than simply describing how we actually speak and write. But when we write the history of a language or when we study a new language, we're also engaged in the problem of prescription and description. When you look, for example, at a grammar book of Old English or of Middle English or of any language, you see prescriptions for behavior. Do people really speak grammatically? Did scribes 1,000 years ago write as grammatically as our modern scholars tell us that they should have? Does anybody really conform to the prescriptions of the grammar book? When we examine the history of English, we will be examining debates on prescription versus description. Now, when we talk about prescription and description, we also encounter one of the central problems for ourselves and for people who come to English from another linguistic or cultural background. And that is, why do we spell the way we do? Why is there such a gap in modern English between spelling and pronunciation? These are important questions because in answering them, we can learn many things. We can learn about etymology, that is the origin of words. We can learn about the attitudes of writers, of speakers, and teachers towards the relationship between spelling and speaking. Let's take some examples. Let's take some simple words like night, knee, no, marriage, name, enough. There was a time when one would have not said night, but knicht. One would not have said knee, but kne. One would not have said no, but kno. One would have said mariage, nama, and enoch. Now, these spellings are historical. And one of the things we're going to explore in this course is why English spelling is historical. What I mean by that is that English spelling conventions do not record the way in which we actually speak. Rather, these spelling conventions record the ways in which the words were pronounced hundreds and hundreds of years ago. One of the things we'll see in a future lecture is just how scholars, pedagogues, and grammarians of the 16th and 17th century, in effect, decided that we would spell in particular ways. Why spelling in English became divorced from pronunciation. And furthermore, how dictionaries in the 18th and 19th centuries codified, or some might even say fossilized, older historical spelling conventions. Now, if we're asking questions about why we spell the way we do, we also have to ask questions about why we pronounce words the way we do. The history of English pronunciation is a history of sound changes. And these sound changes can be charted, and we can even recover earlier pronunciations of English through a series of laws or conventions or rules. Now, during the earliest period of recorded English, the Old English period, which begins probably in the late 7th century and stretches until the middle of the 12th century, English vowels and consonants were pronounced pretty much in the same way as European vowels and consonants were pronounced. But Old English, as we will see in future lectures, had a very special set of sounds, in particular of consonant clusters, that gave it a distinctive verbal and oral texture. Over time, speakers of Old English came in contact with speakers of other languages, notably the French-speaking Normans from the Norman Conquest in 1066. This contact with other languages helped provoke changes in pronunciation. Vowels and consonants came to be pronounced differently. Even later, contacts among dialects and among speakers of other forms of English helped provoke a different set of sound changes. One which we will explore in great detail in this course is known as the Great Vowel Shift, a complete systematic change in the pronunciation of stressed vowels in English, which happened at the beginning of the 15th century and probably didn't reach its conclusion until the end of the 16th century. The Great Vowel Shift radically changed the way in which English is pronounced. Indeed, it separated the pronunciation of English both from its earlier forms and from other European languages. It is a phenomenon such as the Great Vowel Shift that explains why the language of Chaucer at the end of the 14th century is only barely comprehensible to somebody like Shakespeare at the end of the 16th century, and why the language of Shakespeare, written perhaps 400 years ago, is still very comprehensible to us, because no comparable change in pronunciation, in the system of pronunciation, has really interceded between Shakespeare's time and our own. But languages continue to change, and the pronunciation of English continues to change in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. What are the differences between American and British English? This will be a central question we will need to explore as well. How can we explain regional dialects? How can we explain differences among those dialects? How can we explain the apparent uniformity of American English, even though there are regional dialect variations? And, on the other hand, how can we explain the apparent variety of English still spoken in the British Isles? Most American dialects are mutually comprehensible. We recognize them as regional differences, yet we can understand them. Yet there are many regional variants of English in the British Isles which we may find completely incomprehensible. Why is that so? Similarly, why is it that changes in pronunciation, changes in spelling, changes in the relationship among speech, writing, and dialect, why is it that these different changes have seemed not profoundly to have affected English grammar? When we learn grammar, we learn rules, we learn conventions. When we study other languages, sometimes we are overwhelmed by the grammar of those languages, by things like grammatical gender, masculine, feminine, and neuter nouns. French, German, Spanish, and other languages have them. We do not. Why do our verbs end in such seemingly simple ways? Why do we no longer have case endings as the markers of grammatical relationships in sentences? These kinds of questions need to be explored from a historical perspective. Of course, English was not always like that. Old English, as we will see, was a fully inflected language. What does that mean? It means that meaning was determined by case endings, by endings on words that told you the relationships among those words in a sentence? What was the subject? What was the object? What number was the subject and its relationship to the verb? Meaning was, in fact, not largely determined by the order of words in a sentence, as it is in modern English. Over time, English shifted from a highly inflected to a highly uninflected language. Word order tends to become the bearer of meaning in the language, rather than case endings. Why did this happen? What we're going to see is, in addition to changes in pronunciation and spelling, similar changes in grammatical categories were going on. Yet, there are many forms of English that preserve what we might call older or fossilized endings, or bits and pieces of the language that seem archaic. And I want to pause here for a minute and digress on the notion of archaism. One of the things we're going to be looking at in this course is how we can use literary documents, works by great writers, but also works by people we may not know, texts, diaries, journals, and so on, that enable us to reconstruct earlier forms of the language. But what I also want to impress upon you is the way in which, in your everyday reading, or even in your memory of the sounds and forms of words, you can reconstruct the history of English itself. And this is the notion of the archaic, the way in which certain texts or certain documents preserve old forms. One of the best examples of this, with which we're going to be spending a fair amount of time, is the King James Bible. Now, the King James Bible was produced by a collection of scholars under the aegis of King James I, and it was published in 1611. This Bible is based not only on a translation of original texts, but also on other biblical translations, translations stretching from the Old English, the Middle English, and the early modern period. It seems to me, a conscious decision on the part of the translators and compilers of the King James Bible to produce not a record of the English language as it was spoken in 1611, but rather to produce a highly crafted, artificial, elevated, and at times archaic language. A language that will stand not just the test of time, but that will contain within it the time frame of the history of English. When we think casually about the King James Bible, when we think casually about early English or Old English, we think about bits and pieces of words. We think about endings like doth or goest or thou. Now, what's really at stake in looking at these little shards or fragments of old words? We're going to see how these forms develop, but we're also going to see why we think of them as exemplar of an earlier form of the language. Doth, goest, thou. By the time the King James Bible had come out, many of these forms are already archaic. Writers of the early 17th century noted, in fact, that everyone was saying does, goes, not doth and goeth, but that a spelling convention had been maintained from earlier forms, that old th ending. It's a conscious archaism. Let's think of other forms of archaism that we find. Later in the course, when we look at American English, we're going to look at some of the great examples of writings of the 19th century. In particular, we're going to look at Lincoln. We're going to look at Frederick Douglass. We're going to look at Melville. Are these writers accurately recording the language of 19th century Americans? Or are they looking back to models of ideal elevated language and rhetoric? Something like the Gettysburg Address from the mid-19th century. is as much a testimony to late 18th century Jeffersonian and Websterian American political oratory as it is also a text that resonates with the King James Bible and with Shakespeare. Melville's Moby Dick is as Shakespearean as anything we might encounter. And Frederick Douglass, the African-American autobiographer of the mid-19th century, who can on one page of his writings record the speech of his contemporary African-Americans, the language of song and story, can also, as we will see, segue into Shakespeare, as if the texture of his tongue had been so conditioned by the reading of great early authors that he could not forget the sound of the language. I'd like to suggest, in fact, I'd like to argue in this course of lectures, that the history of English is not simply to be found in grammar books or dictionaries or in histories of the language or in linguistic studies, but the history of English is to be found in our own speech and in the works of literature that we read and that we remember. To understand the history of English is, in fact, to understand the history of our own culture and society. Now, in order to enact this understanding, we need to move directly towards a set of methods and a scope. Now, when we think about the history of English, we need also to think about the history of language itself. And what I'd like to do is lay out, as it were, the roadmap of our journey for the next set of lectures. This is a long course. We're going to have 36 lectures tracing the history, structure, and forms of the language. And to some degree, I'm going to, how can I put it, front load some of this material. My next lecture is going to talk a little bit about method. It's going to talk about the ways in which we can use the techniques of historical linguistics to understand problems in the study of language generally. Then we're going to move to the period of Indo-European, a language, a peoples for which there are no real written documents, but for whom scholars have reconstructed a language and a history. From Indo-European, we move to the language of Old English, the Anglo-Saxon Germanic peoples who came to the British Isles in the 5th and 6th centuries AD and displaced the indigenous Celtic-speaking population, a population, by the way, that had also learned some Latin from the colonizing Romans who had been there for nearly 4 centuries. From Old English, we will move to Middle English, the language that evolves or develops out of the confluence of English, Old English, and Norman French, and that, in effect, becomes one of the key vernaculars of the British Isles from about the middle of the 12th century until about the middle of the 15th century. With the great vowel shift, with changes in the language, with the rise of print, and with the beginnings of science and exploration, we move into the period we call modern English, roughly at the end of the 15th and beginning of the 16th century. And we will look at the developments of English in the British Isles until the present day. But we will also look at English abroad. How does English move from Britain to America, from America abroad, from Britain to other colonial possessions? What is the nature of English in what we could call a post-colonial world? How does the English language change in Australia, in South Africa? What is the impact of the media, of computers, of science and technology on English? But also, what is the place of what we might call the scientific study of English? Throughout this course of lectures, we're going to be looking at not just the history of English, but what we might call the history of histories of English. That is, how people studied the history and structure of their language. And in particular, we're going to be looking at the history of linguistics. Now, that's a very daunting term, and I don't want to get terribly technical here when I invoke a word like linguistics. But in general, the study of language in the large is linguistics. There were 12th century linguists, much as there were 15th century linguists, or 17th century linguists, and 19th and 20th century linguists. When we look at medieval and Renaissance attitudes towards language, when we look at spelling reformers of the 18th century, when we look at dictionary makers from Samuel Johnson through James Murray and the making of the Oxford English Dictionary, to contemporary American dictionaries, when we look at a figure such as Noam Chomsky, great American linguistic theorist, we are going to be looking at the history of the study of language. And this course of lectures moves, as it were, towards a telos, towards a goal, which is really a larger set of questions, not about grammaticality or pronunciation or spelling, but about the fundamental relationship between language and mind, language and culture, language and the self, language and the literary imagination. The goal of this course, as I see it, is to move us towards a deeper and richer understanding of how the history and structure of English perhaps not just shapes or informs, but may even generate our structures of thought, our habits of mind, our idioms of cultural and personal expression. So when we move towards the close of this set of lectures, we're going to be moving not just to the present day, but towards the future. What will happen as English changes? What will the status of English be in the world as we will see it? But the world of our children or our grandchildren will see it. My son is 5 and a half, and he's in kindergarten. And I've watched him to this point grow and learn, and just this week, he's beginning to learn to read. Now, I consider this a living laboratory of English, and I see the history and structure of the language in his tone, his speech, his idiom, his mistakes, his joys, and his pleasures. And one of the things I think we all will recognize is that as we have learned to speak, or as we watch our children or our grandchildren or our nieces and our nephews speak and come to read, that we are watching not just the development of an individual personality, but we are watching the trajectory of English happen once again. We're watching things in errors and in successes that mime the history and structure of English. When my son said "pisgetti" for spaghetti, my friends laughed. But I said "metathesis." Now, metathesis is the reversal of certain sounds in a word. And when I said "metathesis," my friends laughed at that. But I realized that in that kind of mistake is a historical example why we say "bird" instead of the Old English "brid," metathesis. Why we say "thunder" instead of "thunor." Why we say "ask" instead of "axe." These are examples of metathesis. Now, these are historical examples, but they may be regional examples too. We ask ourselves, what's the difference in a dialect? What's the difference between a standard and a substandard or a non-standard? What's the difference between the language of a child and the language of an adult? I want to stress in closing this lecture two things. First, that we may see the history of English in our own reading, in our own experience, and in our own lives. But furthermore, that we have to understand that the history of English is in fact not the history of childhood. Earlier forms of English are not infantile, they're not undeveloped, they're not wrong. Similarly, regional forms of the language are not substandard or ungrammatical necessarily. Rather, the richness and scope of English historically, geographically, culturally, socially, personally, and intellectually These are resources which contribute to the larger scope and structure of our course of study. And so I'm going to leave this lecture and invite you to join me next time as we look at some of the detailed ways, the methods of understanding the history of language, and then move on through our exploration of Indo-European, Old, Middle, and Modern English to the language of our own time and our children's. Thank you.